Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Voices of Hope. This is episode 14. We're already on episode 14. And so May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and what I thought we would do is bring two of our best therapists from New Hope onto the podcast. And that's EJ and Joy Barklage. And they're going to talk about the importance of removing stigma from mental health and walking through those doors of hope with others and with yourself. And so I hope you enjoy our conversation. They're great people. I know it's long, but hopefully you can listen to this in a car ride, on your way to work, or exercising, or cleaning, or something like that. I think it's worth listening to the whole thing. So enjoy the conversation. All right. Joy and EJ, thanks for joining me today. I wanted you to actually, EJ wanted to come on the podcast.
Why?
No, I had asked you guys like way back in, what, February?
Correct.
And you went on vacation, so we couldn't do it. And then and things just kind of kept going. And then one day you came up and said that you wanted to do the podcast.
I don't think so. You approached us.
I did approach you. But... we thought it would be, you came up and said that you thought it'd be good we do it this month.
I sent you an email telling you that May was Mental Health Awareness Month.
Yes. Yep. And so here we are.
So that's the rest of the story.
We'll stop trashing EJ now and then we'll. So EJ and Joy, just share a little bit about yourselves for people that may not know you and why you entered the field of mental health to start us off.
Well, I have been a therapist for about 35 years, and I was a nurse prior to that. As a nurse, one of the things that was impressive to me was that human beings are magnificent, and the thing about nursing that I liked the most was being with the patients who are suffering for one reason or another. And that felt like the greater fit in what I was doing. So I decided to go back to school and become a therapist. So that's how I ended up here.
Great. EJ?
Well, the heavens opened. I heard an angelic voice.
Did you have a...
saying, you need to get into therapy. So actually, I didn't anticipate going into the mental health field. When I went to grad school, I was a Master Divinity major. And then after I got into therapy and saw that the pulpit was used as a weapon, I changed it to Master of Arts. Didn't want to be MDiv. And it's not always the case, but my experience at that time when I was in my middle 20s was that. But I took a class called Effective Interpersonal Relationships for non-counseling majors in grad school. And it's actually when I was an MDiv major. And that really opened up kind of a whole different world for me. And I saw that it's something that intrigued me, but also I always believed that we were fearfully and wonderfully made, and was really interested in being a part of the process of reconciliation in relationships, and so changed my major to counseling. And my undergrad was in business administration, so I really, it was really kind of a left turn for me. So that's how I ended up kind of becoming a counseling major. And currently, I'm director of a nonprofit called Caris Community. And I think what drew me to Caris was the concept of community and relationships. And that's what I appreciate about New Hope, too. I feel like that it's a community that's really based on including everyone and encouraging everyone to heal their image of God and to love God and love others. So for me, it's been the major thing has been the relationship. relationship piece.
So I didn't know you were a nurse, Joy. Mm-hmm. Do you use some of that medical background you have yet for some of your therapy work?
Background's a good way to put it. I have an understanding when people come in with health issues, but my experience is so old at this point that I would never be able to function as a nurse now. But I think I do understand the medical piece often when people come in, and I think that you know, we are whole people, and so having the eyes maybe to see the physical part of someone's need as well as the emotional and spiritual need has been helpful.
Yeah. And EJ, you don't have to quote scripture because I don't, you're going to show me up. So that's kind of wonderful to hear some of those stories of, especially for people that are kind of struggling with what they want to do with their life, and maybe they're already in a career. Were you actually a nurse in hospital for a while before you switched over?
I was a labor delivery nurse.
Okay.
And then an educator in the hospital for so a total of about 7 years.
Wow.
But the change of careers, I think, is an important piece. I think a lot of young people don't know what they want to do when they go to college now, and I think that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard somewhere along the line that you need to try a lot of things, and then when you find the thing that feels like you're making music, that's the thing you choose.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the thing that was most meaningful was just being present with people who were suffering for one reason or another, and for others it would be something else, but I did feel God's presence in those moments the most.
Yeah. Okay. And then EJ, you said something about how you're going to become a pastor. And and then you just said a short thing that you kind of threw away. And people that are listening are probably like, wait, I want to hear more about that. What does he mean that using the pulpit as a weapon or the sermon as a weapon?
So I think my experience in growing up and with my faith journey is I had an image of God being an angry God and a punishing God. And I think in that it was kind of a dutiful responsibility to kind of toe the straight line and win God's favor. And I think when I was in grad school and I switched my major to counseling, we were encouraged to get into therapy. And I think that it was through that process of kind of experiencing unconditional love from the person that I was working with. And it was through that process that I became more aware of what I feel like is a truer image of God for me, which was a God of love. And yet in that period of time, you know, we would have chapel, and I would go to chapel during the week, and I would hear what people were saying, and it felt really, from this standpoint, that God was angry, and it was kind of a moralistic kind of message that would be given, and I had this conflict, like, wait a minute, that's not how I'm experiencing God, and that's not who I believe God is. And so I was just more aware, and even when I'd be in worship services on Sunday, I would just, that would kind of really come out to me when it just seemed like that the pulpit was being used in a way that I felt like was in opposition to, I believe, who God was. And so, anyway, that's not my gifts either. Kind of I knew it wasn't going to be preaching and all of that, and so it wasn't a good fit, and I chose that path because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Kind of when I had a spiritual awakening, I would say at 21, where my relationship with God became more personal, and from that point, it kind of led me out of the business field into kind of pursuing grad school and then ending up in the counseling field. So.
Good. Yeah, because I think sometimes people don't always understand the difference between some of those messages when we're using the Bible and God as kind of this weapon to control people. It does a really good job of keeping people's butts in the seats at church, but it's harmful to people in many ways. EJ, you and I have talked about that lots of times because we kind of grew up with similar experiences with faith and how that was used in our lives. So we can have a whole other podcast just on that, on spiritual health, right? But next question for you guys is, because EJ was so eager to be on the podcast, because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, why is it important for us to have a month where mental health is made more aware to the general public?
Well, I think in general, we still have a lot of shame and stigma around mental health. And everyone has a story that'll break your heart if you get to know someone well enough. So it's a part of our shared humanity that we all struggle. And to make it safe for people to be seen and therefore have the courage to seek help to accomplish their goals or to make changes in their lives is an important thing. Otherwise, people stay stuck, and we then encourage a depersonalization of people if we are critical of them because of an emotional struggle in their lives, when in fact we all at some point in our lives need someone alongside of us to be an encouragement or a help, or to help us with perspective or skills to make changes.
So it's not a pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Well, it's probably the opposite. Mm-hmm. I think that relational wounds are best healed in the context of a relationship, and that change has to come from the inside. And that when we just self-talk, for example, is not very effective unless we internalize that. And the process of internalizing that is often follows the opportunity to change one's perspective on their value as a human being. And in terms of relationship with God, I think if we see God as our creator and that we're made in his image, that gives us inherent value and worth. But when we see God as a punitive God, then being created in that image isn't as reassuring and isn't as safe. But I think it's really important that we communicate to everyone that we are all more alike than we are unlike, so to speak, and that just because we might struggle with an emotional issue or a loss or a challenge that's overwhelming doesn't make us any less valuable, and neither does the struggle make us any less valuable. We're all in this together.
Do you have anything to add, EJ?
I do. So I think the stigmatism that Joy was talking about is rampant in the United States around folks that may struggle with a mental health or mental illness. And I think at CARIS, we really try to underline that everyone holds value and is significant in their own right. A favorite Brené Brown quote I have is, worthiness doesn't have prerequisites. And I think having a month set aside for mental health awareness, I think, underlines that truth for folks. And so 42.5 million Americans struggle with mental health issues or mental illness. So that's one in five. And it's okay to be able to talk about high blood pressure, diabetes, whatever physical health that you may struggle with. And yet somehow we have separated and set aside mental health as less important, which I think it is central to our well-being and our functioning. I mean, how we love ourselves is how we love others. And I think, you know, the definition of ignorance isn't, you know, absence of knowledge or information. So I think when we're able to inform people more accurately about mental health and mental illness, I think it allows them the opportunity to choose how they respond and treat people. And so I think it's crucial that we have a month set aside to be able to inform people that we all struggle. And I think I have not met anybody that has not had a significant loss or trauma in their life. So I think Joy talked about the shared humanity or common humanity. I think we all experience it at some point in our life. And some of us have a history of it in our family, and it's genetic, it's biological, it's brain-based, just like any other genetic health issue that you may have. And so I think it normalizes that this is something that everyone struggles with, and we don't have to sweep it underneath the rug.
Yeah. In seminary, they kind of taught us different ways that we could make a mental health like an awareness during worship. And I've been trying one of them out the last month or so. When I do the prayer at church, is I also pray for the sicknesses and struggles that we can't see. Because a lot of times when we talk about stuff in church, it's about, you know, somebody has cancer or somebody's in the hospital and things like that. But even just throwing in that small piece of the illnesses we can't see, and that, whether that's emotional, mental, they talked about that be a good way to kind of put it in there. And I think we forget about that, that's something that people really struggle with.
And I think it does somehow lessen the shame,
mm-hmm.
and kind of communicates, you know, this is a part of our struggle and suffering that we have to walk through, mm-hmm. As human beings. And I think why counseling is so important and significant, I think it, you know, Joy mentioned this, that I think healing takes place in the context of a relationship. And I think when you have community, it just builds on the number of opportunities there are for that to occur within relationships. You know, I experienced that at New Hope, I experienced that at Caris, and I think we can't live without community.
Yeah. So, having a time where we can be aware of mental health, I think, like you guys were saying, is important, because it's something a lot of us don't think of. It's still stigmatized a little bit. Do you think, this is kind of off the cuff question, but do you think there's a lot of people that struggle with mental health but don't even realize that that's what's going on in their lives?
I think it's very easy to project what we feel externally, perhaps onto other people, or to attribute the conflicts, for example, that we might have in life with circumstantial things, rather than having the courage to see oneself and take responsibility for what we see. And again, I think that can be a pretty threatening thing if we're not really believing in our inherent worth. It's a bigger risk to be honest with oneself if you're not convinced that you have value just because you exist, just because you've been created by God in God's image. I think it makes it really tough to own our responsibility for things.
What are some of the things, you are both therapists in different types of roles, but what are some of the things that you wish that people understood about mental health?
Well, I do believe that it is important sometimes to have a bridge to hope. And sometimes we can't hold that hope for ourselves. And that's why the body of Christ is important. That's why it's important to understand that we're all human beings and that we're created with a need for relationship. That it is important that we be there for one another, and it's important that we reach out when we have a need rather than suffering in silence or feeling as though, as we've said numerous times, we'll be shamed for expressing a need. But all of that is just part of being a human being. And so I would hope that people would understand that there is hope in reaching out and not shame. The other thing that recently has been in the news and in every magazine that you pick up is the notion of neuroplasticity. There's a lot of research being done in that area, and I think it's very exciting, and it really affirms what we know about God as Christians, that we're created with the capacity to change. And there's lots of exciting science that says no matter how old we are, we have the ability to create new pathways in the brain that allow dysfunctional ones to shrink. They never probably go away completely, but the more we practice those new pathways, the more change and transformation occurs in our lives. And it's pretty exciting to see that validated in science, even though we know that God works in those ways in our lives. So I would hope that people would understand that there is the potential for change. There is the potential to make something good out of something bad. And so that hope is important.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because so I see a therapist. Well, yeah, I haven't seen him for a long time. But so this fall I was working with him on the stuff around shame and how that was something that basically my brain was just wired with, because the area where I grew up, I started to realize a lot of what they do is built around shame. And if you don't agree with somebody, that means they're bad people. Not that you just disagree, but that they're bad people. And so, and then whenever I did things I thought people didn't agree with or something like that, I got so much shame, like I'm a bad person. And while going to the therapist, I noticed, like, I started thinking differently, being able to handle some of that stuff better. But now, since I stopped going and haven't done the work, it's like creeping back in, you know. And so what was that term you used? Neuroplasticity?
Neuroplasticity,
right? Uh-huh. And so that's the idea that
that the brain is plastic, basically, that it's moldable. No matter how old we are, we're capable of changing ways of being that have not been helpful. And they're finding out a lot about how we're hardwired for compassion, for example.
Is that kind of like EMDR stuff? Is that have to
EMDR do? EMDR is a method or a tool that can be used to process a number of things, trauma being one. But there is some science around changes that occur in the brain.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be the only term I throw out that I know. I was waiting for it. I was like, I'm going to sound smart. Bring up EMDR. EJ, do you have, you look eager to jump in.
You know, I would say the same. I think one of the taglines we have at Caris is that it's a place of hope and healing. And I think without hope, we perish. And I remember someone in the community years ago kind of communicating that they were grateful that, you know, myself or one of the staff helped them hold on to hope when they couldn't embrace it themselves. And so I think that there's always hope. And I think that it is important for people to know it's okay to struggle. And because we're human, we're gonna struggle. And we are imperfect people. One of the things that we celebrate at Caris when someone leaves is they have a couple gifts they're given, but one is a kintsugi bowl. And kintsugi is the Japanese artwork of repairing broken pottery, and it's done with gold or silver. And what happens after the vessel that's been broken is repaired is that it's more beautiful and valuable than it was before. And I think that we talk a lot about people being able to embrace their brokenness, and that it takes a lot of vulnerability and risk to do that. And so I think that for me, I think it would just encourage people to be courageous and to be able to seek help when they need it, because we all need it at some point in our life.
I think it's a myth that I hope people are getting past, but the preconception, I think, is that you have to have a deep psychological issue, mm-hmm. you know, to go to therapy. And while therapy can assist with those things, I think there are a lot of missed opportunities then for people who could benefit from some assistance before things get to that point. And sometimes it just requires a reset, and perhaps seeing things with new eyes or through someone else's eyes can provide that. Sometimes it's as simple as learning a few skills. Sometimes it is about a deeper healing and rebuilding or transformation, as EJ was describing. But there is a continuum of need, and I don't want people to be left with the idea that counseling is only appropriate if you absolutely mm-hmm. fall flat on your face and don't know how to get up. That in the body of Christ we can find encouragement at all levels, and I think sometimes counseling can be the bridge from one place to another, and that it's probably helpful to everyone. Yeah. You know, I know EJ and I have been in our own therapy and are better therapists because of it, but I think better human beings mm-hmm. certainly have better relationships because of it.
Well, and I wouldn't have been able to make the commitment to Joy. I mean, I spent many years in therapy because of that. And it was through the process of going to counseling that I was able to stop pushing people away and not be afraid of intimacy or getting close. The other thing that I thought about around this question was the Rohr quote that if we do not transform our pain, we will certainly transmit our pain. And I think that's the other thing that's hopeful, is that we all have pain, and if we're not aware of it, and we use it to push people away, we use it to move away from people, and we use it to move against people. And I think that, you know, that relationships are about intimacy, and how is it that we can be vulnerable and take risk and let people see who we are. And so I that's just something that I think that the counseling process really helps, but I think I even extend it into the church or anybody's relationship with God, that I think that God is in the business of transforming our perception of who we think God is. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened for me. And it started when I got into therapy years ago. And there's a quote by Thomas Merton that I came across. Oh, let me see if I can find it. But he basically says that if we are not able to look at where we are
You found the third today page
spiritually.
You don't see
it. I don't see it. But he basically was saying, if you were to go back 5 years mm-hmm. and look at where you are today spiritually, and if you're not able to call yourself a heretic, then you haven't grown spiritually. Hmm. And I think that is so true, because I think we are constantly growing in God's committed to transforming how we view ourselves, how we view God, and how we view others. And so I think, you know, counseling is a tool that assists in that process. But I mean, that's what I love about New Hope, is I feel like that we are encouraged to move out of our places of comfort and to kind of question, but also to think more about, you know, who God truly is and who we truly are, and how is it that we're loving God with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and how are we loving our neighbors, ourselves? Because what I have found out, I think, through the process of therapy or counseling, is I was doing just that. I was loving people as I was loving myself, which wasn't very well.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Do you think, what was the question I was going to ask? What are some examples of, like, smaller things? Like, Joel, you were talking about how sometimes people feel like they only need to go to therapy if it gets to be this big. Like, let's say somebody's think about taking their own life. Sometimes people think that's the time to go to therapy. And you're saying, no, it's way before that you can go to therapy. What are some examples of things that people deal with that therapy can help them kind of work out, like, everyday stuff that they...
Mm-hmm. I think some people come to therapy out of loneliness, that they're isolated and they don't have a support system around them. And some people come to therapy because of a loss. Some people come to therapy because they're having issues at work or getting along with people. Mm-hmm. There are conflicts in marriage, and wise people go to therapy if they're having trouble in their marriage when it's a communication issue and not an affair. Mm-hmm. there are just lots and lots of growth edges that can get bigger, and the wedges of the division in our lives can get bigger. Self-esteem, and personally I don't like the term self-esteem, but often that's the language that we use when we talk about needing to discover our value. And
do you prefer self-compassion?
I do.
Man, smart again for me.
You know, self-esteem is dependent on the peaks and in our lives. We jump from success to feel good about ourselves. Self-compassion is something that's consistent because it's based on who we are and our value just because we exist, and treating ourselves with the same kindness that we treat other people. And that can be a consistent across many circumstances. So I do like that word. And I think we're hardwired for compassion, and to extend that internally just helps us have more available to others. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. That connects with what EJ was saying about learning how to love yourself first before you can love other people and help other people. You've been kind of interweaving some scripture, some faith, spirituality into what you guys are talking about. And obviously, I think through our conversation, it seems like your faith has played a role in deciding to go into the mental health field, to be therapists. Do you have any more you want to say about that? Does that...
I would say my faith is central. It's kind of like the rudder on the boat for me. And I think it's because I do believe of the original blessing, and that we are all made in the image of God. And the biggest attribute for me, for God, is God's goodness. And that is my biggest hope for people, is that they are able to embrace the goodness that lies within them. Because I think we have so much shame and guilt that we have internalized growing up, and even in our adult years we can experience that. And yet, that's contrary to how I see who God is. And so for me, I think when you believe that people are inherently good, and that we are created for relationships. And for me too, that's kind of modeled within the Trinity. That, you know, there's a relationship within God, and that was kind of the imprint from the beginning, that I think the relationship is why we're here.
You listen to the sermon on Sunday.
I think faith is central to the reason that I'm here and do what I do. I don't always directly speak to it, but it's one of those things. If somebody opens the door to go there, then I certainly want to help them integrate their faith with their psychological health. But it's one of those things that you preach the gospel at all times and sometimes use words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that being mindful of God's presence in the room, whether you say anything about it or not, makes a big difference in how I listen and how I see people. And as EJ was mentioning, that original goodness, so often people come in because they are not seeing their own goodness, or they're not seeing themselves very clearly. And so to be able to mirror back to someone how precious they are comes from my faith and the magnificence to me of being created in God's image. I think my whole life that has been the principle that I've hung on to when I've been discouraged about a number of things, or when I've been in situations where there's a lot of judgment, is all of us are created in the image of God, and that makes every human being so magnificent. And I think that holding that value is an important foundation for holding the pain, you know, that people mm-hmm. feel. Part of being created in the image of God is the capacity to grow and change and create. And that is the other most exciting thing, I think, to me, is that we are genuinely created with the capacity to heal. And we understand that physically. If you have a cut on your hand, you just expect it to heal, and it does most of the time. But if you really think about the process of that healing, it's truly amazing. And I think the same thing applies in our spiritual lives and in our mental health, that we don't have to stay where we are. EJ used the Kintsugi model. A model that I like is the pearl, that starts out as a source of pain in the oyster, and the oyster creates this solution that it surrounds the pain with, layer after layer after layer, and eventually you don't see the painful grain of sand, you see this beautiful pearl. And I think that's a picture of what God does in our lives, whether we know it's God doing it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing that is so important in counseling is forgiveness, the concept of forgiving oneself and forgiving others. And what better model do we have for that than our faith and Jesus Christ and so many stories of restoration and reconciliation throughout Scripture are great metaphors for what can happen and does happen when people find the grace to open up.
Mm-hmm.
The other notion that is important is that God is present all the time. And there is great security and peace in that. But it also is modeled in our body life at New Hope, like EJ was mentioning, and in our shared humanity. I think one of the things that we hope for in therapy is that the same grace someone experiences in their own healing, then they're willing to pass on or grant someone else. And that, I think, is very important in healing relationships and not having so much of an us and them culture.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those things, I think every therapist would agree with. But I just see the source of all those things as coming from the magnificence of how we're created.
Sometimes I like, this is an oversimplification, but like the whole Christian narrative, the whole Bible, I always feel like the simplest way I can explain it is God just saying, chill out. Like, chill out. You don't have to be God. You don't have to prove yourself, but you are loved. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the whole Christian narrative in the Old Testament, all the wars, all the power struggles, is all about humanity trying to be God and prove something to their God. And then Jesus comes and says, you guys all need to chill out, and you are loved, and that's why I'm here to tell you. And even 2,000 years after Jesus, we're still trying to let people know that. And I think in a culture that's rampant with comparing each other because of the access to information we have in social media and things like that. And so I think people start to feel a deep sense of that they don't belong or they're not good enough, because we're just seeing the highlight reel of everybody else's life. But I think what you guys are saying is it's the nail on the head about you are loved and cared for.
St. Francis of Assisi says, or said, that sometimes we need to reteach all things their loveliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sums up therapy for me, is that we need to help people rediscover their loveliness and their inherent value and worth and purpose.
Yeah.
You know, another thought that kind of came to my mind during this discussion was that we're enough. And I think that, you know, whether people are coming through the front doors of Caris or whether they're coming, you know, into a counseling office, or they're coming into the front doors of a place of worship, I think the majority of folks may struggle with them feeling like they're not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, what God says is that you are enough. And you know, there's another quote by Rohr I like that says, there's nothing to prove and nothing to protect. I am who I am, and it's enough. And you know, one of the things that I communicate with folks, and we have this tradition at Caris called a rock passing when people leave, and I say that their 1 month review is, my hope is that they will see that they are enough. And because I think that's one of our biggest struggles, is us, that when we don't feel like we are enough. Yeah, and you talked about the sense of belonging, love and belonging. I think that's central, is, you know, for us to deeply know that we are loved and we do belong. And that's, again, why I think community is so important.
Hmm. So, what does it look like to you two, as therapists, to be a fully or wholly healthy person? At least as much as you can be.
I think the courage of imperfection is a part of that. Which I think one can only have if you have that inherent sense of your value. It makes it safe to be imperfect and hope for change. I think community, as EJ's mentioned several times, is absolutely vital. I don't think you can be mentally healthy in isolation. So I think having love, someone to love and be loved by, someone to invest in and to be cared for in return, a sense of purpose, if you will, the ability to forgive, an awareness, and then taking personal responsibility for what we become aware of, I think is important.
I mean, what comes to mind for me is to freely love and be loved.
Yeah, I think this is a lot of good work that a lot of people don't do necessarily. I think people are dealing with a lot of things and struggling with a lot of things that they don't quite understand that their life could be better. if they would work on it. And even talking about how to have self-compassion, self-love, understanding you are enough, that's continued work, right? Like that, you don't just get to a point of like...
You never arrive.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you think you have, you're in trouble.
And so that's hard work. And if somebody's working throughout their whole life with that notion of that they aren't enough, I think that turns out to be a lot harder work to get through a lot of things with that mindset. So things like that and anger and sadness and depression, everything that all falls under the what you guys do, right? You guys help people process those things. And
I think another thing that comes from someone who is experiencing emotional and spiritual health is the ability to suspend judgment on others. I think of when Joe and I went through this training, this Brené Brown training to be certified during lay facilitators, I remember her saying, so what if you believe people are doing the best they can with where they are and what they know? And if you do that, you suspend judgment. And I feel like we all have enough judgment to rest us the last of our life. And I think that's why God's love is so scary, because it's without judgment and we don't know what to do with that. So I think for me, that's an ongoing process, because I judge quite a bit, you know, kind of the 70 times, seven times a day. And so, but I think I'm grateful for that awareness and be reminded of it, because then I can own it. And that's a humbling experience. But then, you know, when you are able to extend that and own that and take responsibility for that, it really also shifts your perception of that person that you're judging. I mean, we all struggle.
I think that's a key component to that a lot of Christianity needs to learn.
It's mudslinging.
Right, yeah.
You know, and this whole thing of who's in and who's out and the need to be right. And I think, you know, that's control. And I think when you're, another sign of health is when your faith is at a point where it's not threatened by what others believe or think about you. And I think for me, the world is so big and God is so big. I think that really, talk about the wonder of God. I mean, it blows my mind. I can't take that all in. But I think that that's another thing too, that's a picture of health where everyone belongs. I mean, we talk about it at New Hope too, that there's sacred in the ordinary and everything is sacred. And when you start to take that in, I mean, it cannot help but transform you.
Yeah. But that, the getting to that place in your spirituality and your faith that you aren't threatened by what other people believe, that's scary in itself to get to that point. I talked about it a little bit in the podcast that released a couple weeks ago. Last week with Justin, about how some of my crisis of faith during seminary and like, because I feel like if you're going to move into that position, you're going to have a crisis of faith. And
most definitely.
You have to go through it, right? It's the darkest night of the soul type of thing from it's Thomas Merton. And that's scary. Yep. I remember starting to question certain things, and I was, you know, I was worried for my soul. I was like, I had called Justin, and I was like, I'm worried I'm going to go to hell. But once you get on the other side of that, and I think it is very rewarding, because it'll help you to suspend judgment because you've gone through some of the fire. Going back to how you say that you judge people all the time, EJ.
I know that you feel better about that yourself now.
Just the other day, Michelle and I went to breakfast at a restaurant and we were coming out and there's this family getting into their van, and is one of those things that you learn from growing up, your family, your community you grew up in, of how you respond to others and think of others. And in my head, I was saying, well, that's an interesting family, like, you know, a very negative thing. But then I stopped myself before I said it out loud. I was like, you know, why am I having that kind of react? Like, why am I judging them for the way they look or what car they're driving, stuff like that, when they could be doing the best they can with what they have and where they are? And I think that's where some of that work pays off. It's not in these big grandiose things, but it's our everyday interactions with other people, right?
I think it's easy to judge if we start out one place spiritually and we end up another. Mm-hmm. You know, EJ and I have had conversations about where we've come from and, mm-hmm. and where we feel like we are now, and sometimes being in the old environments is uncomfortable, or you feel a certain negative feeling when you're there that you don't feel when you're home. And we've had conversations about, well, let's not do the reverse us and them. Uh-huh. You know, when we were in our original faith formation times, there was a lot of judgment about what was Christian or what was Christ-like and what wasn't. And as we have moved in our faith, it's easy then to look back and reverse the us and them.
Yeah.
And I think it's important, no matter where we are, not to create an us and a them. And I get reminded of that all the time if I'm sitting with someone who might have had sort of an awakening or an epiphany, and it seems that they then look back and find situations or people in their lives in which they're angry or critical. Mm-hmm. And it's just the reverse of what they experienced. And so I think health is getting to the place where you're not judging yourself, but you're also not judging the other person.
Health and emotional and spiritual health is not being a stone thrower. And what I mean by that I just remember the whole, the woman caught in adultery, and, you know, they brought it before Jesus, and then Jesus basically said, he's without sin, cast the first stone. Mm-hmm. And for me, Joy asked me, we were on a road trip home from Salt Lake over the weekend, and she asked me, like, what's one of your favorite stories in the Bible? And for me, that one out of John 8 has come, that's been the one that's come to mind to me more frequently. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I need to be reminded of that, you know what? I don't want to be a stone thrower. I am a stone thrower, but I'm grateful when I'm made aware of that so I can put the rest of the rocks down.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that story too. And a lot of this stuff, it is hard because I think a lot of it has to do with reconciliation. It has to do with forgiveness, and that's hard work. And it's easier to flip the tables rather than reconcile with one another. Kind of what you're talking about, once you have the spiritual awakening and you're kind of on the other side of things, now you're judging the people that you perceive to be primitive, I guess, or something like that. And the cycle just happens all over again. And I mean, the best place in our culture that you can kind of see that, I think, is politics, because whenever you switch power, they're always doing the same thing, right? And then the opposition party is always making the party that's in power their life hard to do things. And then while they're doing that, they're also saying we should work together. But then once they get power, right, and the other one doesn't have power, then they don't work. I think that's just human nature. To do that, but there's what you guys are saying, there's hope that people can change, right?
And one of the things that came to mind when you shared that was, you know, the saying we have at CARES, that it's not about me, but it's about we. So I think the other thing with emotional and spiritual health, it's when you're able to step outside of yourself and look at what's going to be the most helpful for those around you, and that what I do and what I don't do, what I say and how I say it, not only impacts me, but it impacts everyone around me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, I think we live in a pretty narcissistic culture. And so I think when you can step outside and say, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be about me.
Yeah.
That's a step towards growth.
Well, do you two feel good with the podcast and how it went and everything? Is there any last minute things you want to add, or?
I'm really glad
or
I
take
asked
back.
That we could do this.
Otherwise, we'll kind of close it. And if people want to find you or seek you out, I mean, Joy, you're a therapist and you meet with people. EJ, you're a director at Caris, right? And so you don't see people in that way, like private practice, correct?
Correct.
All right. So if people want to refer you, or they want to come see you, or they want to tell their family members to go see you, where can they find you? Do you have a website?
I have a website. I use my maiden name, so it's joymeyers.com.
Okay. Is it M-E-Y-E-R?
M-Y-E-R-S.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for joining me, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.